The following is a recording of a discussion group at Ordinary Mind Zendo. The texts we take up for study in these groups range from koan collections to poetry to psychoanalytic papers. If you enjoy listening, please consider donating. Ordinary Mind Zendo is a nonprofit organization that depends on the generosity of people like you.
Someone would like to read the case.
I'll read the case. We're on the Yangshan, right?
Yes.
The Yangshan studied with Zen Master Tonggan, who asked him, "What is the business under the patchwork robe?" The Yangshan had no answer. Tonggan said, "In studying Buddhism, if you don't reach the state, that is most miserable. You ask me and I'll tell you." The Yangshan said, "What is the business under the patchwork robe?" Tonggan said, "It is within." The Yangshan was thereupon greatly enlightened. It is not known
stop,
where...
Stop there. Tongshan's answer is, "It is within."
Yes, it is within.
See, in this translation, it says intimacy.
So that's a big difference.
So that would be interesting. Is that the same or different? How do you want to see these translations? So what is the what's the question here? What's the problem? I was going to anticipate that your translation would have a different word for business, since that seems like a funny question. What is the business beneath the patchwork robe, right? I'm not sure how he got that word or why they're agreeing on that, you know. I mean, you know, when I read a question like that, I can't help think it's, you know, the kind of question Edo Roshi would ask his female students, you know, what's going on under your robe?
Right. I had that thought. Not about Edo.
You know, but it's, but that's the question. What's going on under the robe or behind the robe is asking what? Something like, what's going on behind all the forms of being a monk?
It's right? About essence.
Yeah, I guess it's asking: is there an essence? What is it that animates this? Certainly. The way I would first approach this with somebody is there something other than being good at being a monk, right? Of being someone who has mastered all the forms, right? Who sort of has got this whole thing down, right? And if you've been in any of these communities, there's always somebody who's meticulous, right? They're insufferable usually, but there's this model of how everything's supposed to be done. I mean, and you know, there's certainly a way in which. One can come to rest in a sense of mastery and a sense of rightness about everything, right? I mean, that particularly if you're in a closed community, it's as if you know all the moves and you've got all the bases covered. Right? Whatever happens, you sort of know the thing to do for it. And that's not nothing. I mean, that's impressive. Because people come to these places often because they feel very much at odds with themselves or the world, right? I mean, I think that's the basic kind of suffering that people bring to practice, is they're out of sorts, they're out of sync with themselves and other people and their surroundings. And part of what can be mastered in a Zen community is that sense of getting in sync, right? Of really finally you are a cog in a machine that's working, right? You know your place, you do your thing, you feel like you fit in and you've got a function, and it's working, right? And you can take that inside and feel like what's ever going on inside of you is not at war with itself, but is somehow part of all of this, right? And that's, you could say that's a big positive aspect of training. But the there's some downside in stopping at that level or getting attached to that. And so I'm going to presume that the question is sort of saying, what is there beneath or beyond that sense of the robe, of performing monk, right? We'll see how that gets answered as we go here. Someone will read the next section.
Go ahead. It is not known where Liang Shan was from. He studied with Tongan and served as a personal attendant for 4 years, taking care of his robes and bowl. One time, as Tongan was going up into the hall for the morning congregation, at which it is usual to wear the patchwork robe, Liangshan brought the robe for Tongan. As Tongan took the robe, he asked, "What is the business under the patchwork robe?" Liangshan couldn't answer. When Tongan answered for him, he was greatly enlightened. Liangshan prostrated himself, so moved that his tears wet his robe. Tongan said, "Now that you are awakened, can you answer?" Liangshan said he could. Tongan said, "What is the business under the patchwork robe?" Liangshan said, "It is within." Tongan said, "Inner being, it exists within." After that, Liangshan often spoke of inner being in his teaching. And after he became an abbot, many people asked him about the business under the patchwork robe. Once when a student posed this question, he said, "Even the saints don't reveal it." Another time a student asked, "When it is impossible to guard the home against thieves, then what?" Liangshan said, "If you recognize them, they won't be enemies." The student asked, "How about after recognizing them?" Liangshan said, "You'll exile them to the land of non-origination." The student said, "Isn't that where they settle and live?" Liangshan said, "Stagnant water doesn't hide a dragon."
Let's unpack that a little bit so it doesn't just sound similar to you.
I think this connects to what you were saying earlier. Hmm? Particularly about like dwelling in routine, like that stagnant water. Like the dragon is usually an enlightened person, right?
Yeah. So stagnant water is sometimes an image for getting attached to emptiness or calmness, right? That you think that your job is to banish everything, but this just makes your mind stagnant rather than alive. And the protecting the house against thieves and all this stuff is, it's what's coming in or out and through the senses. Are these things are they disturbances or not? Is the job to banish everything once and for all. That's sort of one picture people have of practice, you know, sort of seal the doors and windows so nothing can get in, right? Nothing will perturb me, right? That's one of the curative fantasies of practice, imperturbability.
Is that what, so when he says you'll exile them to the land of non-origination, is that like the thing where you just let things come and go?
Yeah, I think it means that when you see them as empty, then they have no power. You don't have to really banish them or keep them out. And you're not, at the same time, you're not trying to kill them off, because that just leads to stagnation.
You know, a lot of texts, talk specifically in the language of like, cutting off the senses, or cutting off the thieves, or I don't know, is that like sort of more a Rinzai way, like saying you got to get to this stage at least one time, and then, you know, either go beyond that or things are resolved?
Well, I think people can go down different paths with this, and you can certainly spend time on a concentration practice that tries to do nothing but focus on Mu in a way that pushes aside everything else, just lets that be the world. The dilemma is then whether you can, how to bring stuff back in. See, the real danger is that if you make a certain kind of concentration or equanimity your goal or your notion of a good sitting, then the world becomes your enemy. Everything is sort of intruding, right? Everything's interrupting, right? And it's like you're trying to keep everything out. Then it's like everything is like a thief trying to break in. Right? It's gonna just completely ruin your buzz, right?
And true equanimity be just the opposite?
True
equanimity. Nothing in this world would disturb you, you know?
Well, true.
Why would you be disturbed by it?
Well, in a sense, true equanimity is transparency, right? And in that sense, it's also letting yourself be disturbed. I don't think that there is any good version of equanimity that flatlines you. You know, I'm not sure you want to pursue something that allows you to have just this little blissful half smile on your face no matter what happens. You know, if your child gets hit by a car, that's not the response you want to have.
Yeah, you're not like that, but at some level, don't we have to accept what's in the world, even if it is your child getting hit by a car?
Yes, you accept
it. That's what happens.
You accept that with tears.
And taking it to the hospital.
Right, in action. So you accept this whole flood of reactivity too. You see, I think that you could say that part of what intimacy means, and why I like that as a better translation here, is intimacy has a connotation other places of non-separation. It's intimate with everything and everybody, right? It's not putting up any barriers. So I forget where it is, but it's where somebody asks them, where are you going on your pilgrimage, and what do you expect to accomplish? And the guy says, I don't know. And the master approves, saying, not knowing is most intimate. Mm-hmm. where intimate means that sense of being completely open or non-separate to whatever's going to arise on the pilgrimage, right? And so I would like a translation of this where they said, what's going on under that patchwork robe? Intimacy. I mean, because then you have a slight double entendre to it. which is slight. Good. You want that. You know, you want that sense of what's underneath there, naked, right? Intimate or naked would mean open to the world, open to experience, right?
Interpenetration.
Yes, there you go. Right, that's right. Bend over, I'll reveal the truth. All right, so enough of that, right? Okay. But this, this is some sense, again, with the, you know, as opposed to barring all the doors and windows, it's to be naked or intimate or open or non-separate is what's under under form, right?
So,
yeah, go ahead.
I was curious about where the narrative goes in this paragraph, because, like, you know, he says, like, you know, let the thieves flesh around in your pond, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, they make waves without making a ripple. Mm-hmm. But then he says, he does talk about, I imagine, samadhi or something. He says, how about when the waters are emptied and all the mountains are leveled, right? When, mm-hmm.
Again, it's a sense of, okay, you can go to this place of no difference, right? But this is not your ultimate goal. Somehow you have to return to differentiation, but with a sense of the emptiness of things so that they just come and go. They don't have a central contaminating nature. Right?
What does your book say for where Liang Shan says inner being? What does your book say?
That's intimacy.
Again.
Intimacy.
Again. He repeats that? Oh.
Yeah.
Intimacy, right?
The inner being, it exists within, like that one at the end of the paragraph.
Yeah, I think that's a... it's a much more problematic answer or translation. I mean, the basic teaching is supposed to be of emptiness, of self-nature, right? And yet there's always a temptation to say that once we've discovered that self is empty, behind that there's going to be this new capitalized something, right? And sometimes that gets called being or a mind. This is, to me, a big mistake and a big problem. When you get past the emptiness of self, you're not at some new capitalizable realm that you're now going to be splashing around in this new big pool of mind or being. And you know, mind is not some amorphous, trickly substance that everything else is made out of, right? I mean, we don't want to be idealists here, you know? I mean, that's... this is the problem in Hegel that everybody wrestles with, whether you deal with this sense of spirit being something that has a reality or substance that has its own momentum, reality, and emergence as and in history, right? And there's a big problem whether to interpret him as seeing spirit as a kind of substance behind history or as a way of thinking about history, right?
What emerges from history?
And it's very interesting to me because I've always, at least, read the Charles Taylor version of Hegel, which is probably closer to historically accurate Hegel, as this big metaphysician who sort of has this capitalized spirit, you know, flowing through everything. But there are a couple new interpreters who sort of try to create a non-metaphysical Hegel that sees spirit meaning sort of life as forms of life and socially constructed life going through all these different phases without positing anything behind the scenes, right? It's an interesting different way of reading him. Thing I was posting about on Facebook is about that. I'm giving, commenting on some excerpts of it as I go. But I think Zen is always subject to transcendental fantasies, and I think Buddhism, because Buddhism arises in cultures. Asian cultures that had lots of transcendental cultural myths and languages going on, it easily got involved in all of that stuff. And I think we have to be careful of that language, even if it's in the story of some enlightened master. I mean, they may be enlightened, but they may be lousy philosophers. It may not be a good way to think about being to ever capitalize it.
That's so that thing of like not an inch of ground to stand upon, the mountains are leveled. That's very quickly in like American places linked with ahistorical, acontextual. Like they'll actually say ahistorical, unconditioned experience.
Yes. So I think that. I think that is one of the myths of Buddhism, right? And religion in general, that there is anything that is ahistorical, acultural, this timeless thing that you're plugging into that's behind the scenes. It is always behind the scenes everywhere at all times. I think it's just a little bit of woo-woo that we need to grow out of. And think about how to think of what's going on in practice without falling into that language.
I heard a Zen teacher commenting on the religious experience of a nun who had a vision of the Virgin. And he said, well, that's nice and all, but that's not that's very conditioned.
Mm. Yeah, right.
As opposed to
me, who stands beyond outside all conditioning. We see it. one of the great lines, from Gregory Bateson was, he said one of the surest ways to fall into, he sort of said, an epistemological trap, is to imagine that you are outside of epistemology, right? To imagine. That you don't have a frame of a conditioned frame of reference, right? And this is the this goes back to the kind of appearance and reality the distinction where Sky will say, your experience is conditioned and therefore has the appearance of the Virgin Mary, but mine is unconditioned and is just vast emptiness, right?
Even though I've been reading about that.
You've been reading about that my whole
decades.
Life.
Decades.
Right. if you think that the basic insight is of emptiness, which is not a capital E substance, but simply means impermanence, means everything is constantly changing and interdependent, so has no permanent essential nature of its own, but is always evolving causally. When you see that's the nature of appearances, there is no reality behind them. Right? When you puncture through appearance, it's not that there's something on the other side. All you've done is see the actual nature of what appearances are, right? The whole reality appearance distinction collapses. This is why we say nothing is hidden, right? It's not like there appear a veil of appearances which we will pierce and get behind to a reality of mind or being or emptiness or anything else. All those things are present in appearance. Right?
So you can't comment on the content of someone's experience, like a Virgin Mary.
Yeah, I mean, it's that's just the experience that someone in that culture is going to have. And if you put somebody in a sesshin in a Japanese monastery, their vision probably won't be of the Virgin Mary, right? But it's not clear to me that they have been the ones that have now seen through to the ground of being in a way that no one in any other culture or any other situation is ever able to have, right? I mean, I think that's sort of just culturally hubristic to imagine that this form is the only form that shows the truth about reality and life and death. And it's just silly. So often, as you know, I try to remind people, whenever you see like a capital B being or capital M mind, try to just substitute life in there. And it's
small L.
Yeah, that, yes. we're not inclined to, even if you capitalize it, it's hard to attribute anything intentional, you know, or meaningful to it that way.
When you say life, the only teacher,
that's
you
right.
You could really attribute, well, there's some consciousness there. There's some, the world, life is sending me this annoying person to teach me.
I mean, that idea, you know, it's like life is teaching me a lesson, right? What that means is life is always manifesting impermanence and interconnection. Everything that's happening in life displays those truths. It's teaching you to the extent that moment after moment you resist one of those things, right? Typically we're resisting impermanence all the time, and everything that happens is going to give you a new lesson in impermanence, right? Every day that you get older, you get another lesson in entropy, right? Right? So life is an endless teacher in that it can't help but display these truths that yourself is resisting, self just being a name for all the attempts to control things that are uncontrollable.
But how you're saying it is like there's God. God sent me this.
Right. So people use the word life or the universe.
Yeah.
They want to use the G word.
Well, I think we're just trying to find a way to get ourselves out of that those language traps. And they're traps of intention or meaning or design, right? Or purpose.
When you phrase life teaches, like life is the subject doing that transitive verb, making it sounds...
Yeah, like... that's right. The grammar makes you mm-hmm. think that it's there's an intention, right? Mm-hmm. Or a purpose to it. But you could just sort of say gravity is endlessly teaching you a lesson about mass, right? All right, let's read our way through this a little bit more. We'll go down to thus our first patriarch of the Soto lineage, Tungshan. You have that in here someplace. What's the most painful thing in the world?
Oh yeah.
Somebody.
Once Zen Master Liang Shan asked the monk, "What thing in the world is most miserable?" The monk replied, "Hell is most miserable." Tung Shan said, "No. What is most miserable is to wear this vestment and fail to clarify the great matter."
Yeah, keep going.
Dongshan's great disciple, Yunju, quoted this saying to his disciples and said, "My late teacher said that hell is not what is really miserable. To wear this vestment and yet not understand the great matter is what is really miserable. You should exert yourselves more. Don't weary of your journey for enlightenment. Don't violate the ways of the Zen community." An ancient said, "If you want to be able to carry this matter through, you must stand atop the highest mountain and walk on the bottom of the deepest sea. Only then will you have some life. If you haven't comprehended the great matter for the time being, you should walk the mystic path."
Yeah.
Great matter.
Wow. Yeah, this here it says, "Then you must constantly tread the dark road."
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think in his Taisho, as we go down a little farther, it says, "Even if you look like a monk and half-heartedly join in the Zen community, if you've not clarified this matter, you're just struggling pointlessly without any results. Even less can either beginners or veterans in these corrupt times, in the last days of the Dharma, study thoroughly, their spirits waver. Even if they try to model their mental states and physical deportment after former enlightened ones."
That's pretty good.
Even if mental states and physical deportment are like those of antiquity, if you've not clarified the realm of mind, these are no more than defiled states of humans and celestials. See, I think that I would say, even if you have attained these states in mind and conduct yourself well, if you're still thinking in terms of doing well or badly, you've missed the point. Right? That you're still in the realm of something to overcome or something to accomplish. Then you've just figured out that you've gotten good at this, or you're always worried about not being good at this. Both of those are ditches on the side of the road.
That's what you have us replace the great matter?
Basically, the great matter is to realize the emptiness and interconnection of things, and to be able to live in that world without this self-centered need to attain or dispel anything, right? That there is the great matter is this sense of there's nothing to attain and nothing to get rid of. There's nothing that is contaminating your life and nothing that needs to change in it. This is the twinkling star, right? It is perfect as it's manifesting its impermanence through twinkling moment after moment. And Shakyamuni says, oh, I'm like that too. I've been busting my ass for nothing.
Well, he's been twinkling, he'd say.
He's already twinkling, right? Yeah. He's already twinkling.
In Zen Mind Beginner's Mind, there's one line where Suzuki says, Dogen said that any teaching that doesn't feel like it's forcing itself something on you is not the true teaching. And I don't know, you know, if Dogen ever said something like that, but it struck me because it's like our resistance to, like, life always feels like it's forcing something on you because you want something different, you know, than what is just the way it is.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, it's practice forces on you a kind of, you know, a realization that's painful, you know, that you've got this project, you know, this escape strategy, you know, and it's going to basically tell you it's not going to work. You know, I mean, that was Joko always said that, right? That it takes people, you know, at least a half dozen years to figure out what Zen is all about, and most of them then quit, because you know, it's bad news. If you've got a kind of curative fantasy project going that you've enlisted Zen into, when you really see what it's about, you know, most people quit and go across the road for a different one, right?
I was thinking about that, the Koto Sawaki quote to other Zen teachers saying, if you're not careful, you'll become famous.
Yeah, right.
Like, if it sounds too good, you're telling it wrong.
Yeah,
right. At Jimbo's thing, I met some woman and we were talking about her teacher, who's kind of a Dharma celebrity. Elizabeth's friend's daughter.
Oh, huh.
And it was just an interesting concept, like these Dharma celebrities, these people and their adherents who hitch their wagons to this person. Where it sounds also good.
Yeah, it can. Some people make it sound better than you do.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah. Well, I'm certified charisma free.
The charisma of no charisma.
Yeah. Charisma of no charisma.
But there's no, like, Ito Roshi just totally radiated charisma.
Yeah.
And among other things, I thought, you know, this is a big distraction from, like, how could you learn anything if you're just constantly into this, you know, this great show is going on.
Yeah. I mean, I remember Larry Schoenberg saying studying with Kido Roshi was like taking swimming lessons from a fish. This is completely useless for a human being, right? And when teachers, you know, come across to their students as beings of another order of magnitude, they're not doing them a service, right? They're allowing them to plug into an idealized figure a little bit like a kidney machine. You know, I'm going to provide this life-giving, purifying experience that you can never have on your own, right?
What was occurring to me too, like, you're talking about, like, how this is all constructed, the degree to which it's bottom-up, the way, like, you want your wagon to be hitched to someone great, so you, and then the teacher just colludes with that.
Yeah, the teacher buys right into it, right, as something that, that's what you want, I'll provide it. Now, there's a way in which some teachers will maintain that's a kind of skillful means to let you, you know, work through your idealization, but they will often let you work through your fortune as well as your idealization in the process. You know, I mean, it's like.
But the practice is often hierarchical, or the structure is often hierarchical.
Yeah, I think, that's certainly it's a very hierarchical form that has come down to us, and the Japanese monastic system is that everyone who entered the monastery before you did can give you orders, right? There's that seniority system, right? So that the teacher is less your teacher than the guy one rung up the ladder from you a lot of the time, right? And there's something to that gets worked through in that kind of system. We have relatively little hierarchy, but there's no amount that won't chafe somebody, right?
I think, though, one has to take care, unless one can say that they have experienced everything that exists in this world, one should take care being too sure about it all. And I can't say anything more than that. I think we need a real deep humility about what this world is about.
Well, I can't argue with that at all. I mean, it's... I think that have to be very humble about imagining this practice will make you impervious to whatever life throws at you. I mean, you know, I watched Joko be affected by old age, and that was not a pretty sight. You know, I don't pretend to any sense that, I could take anything, you know. I think that's just hubris to imagine that you arrive at this place, right? And there are a lot of stories of teachers who don't necessarily die as advertised, you know. I mean, Joko thought that was... another ridiculous notion, and now, even dying is something you have to do well. But we get into this fantasy, the teacher is going to announce his death the day in advance and die sitting in full lotus, right?
Where is there room for pleasure in all of this and joy? I mean, this is...
I'm having fun.
What?
Yeah, I'm having fun.
I repeat my question. I'm serious. I mean, it just feels like it's all doom and gloom, and then we drop dead,
Well, that's true, too.
Well, I prefer an illusion of something... In addition to that.
Well, look, I think that the aspect of life is suffering is compounded with when you're always organized around the failing attempt to control things. Somebody said anxiety is the experience of trying to control the uncontrollable. So most people live in a state of chronic anxiety because life is basically uncontrollable. But I think that there's, in fact, a kind of experience in practice of relatively letting go of control. I don't think anybody does it entirely. A profound relaxation and letting things alone. A sense, for me, a sense of really letting my mind alone, not being endlessly anxious or preoccupied about my internal state, sort of the end of this kind of how am I doing question, right? I mean, when that stops, It really is like taking off tight shoes. I mean, you know, you really can appreciate a lot more if you're not preoccupied with this kind of internal, oh my God, why this, why that stuff, right? I'm telling you. There is a lot of wiggle room for joy that I think you gain if you let go of some of that internal project and judgment.
Doesn't the last paragraph in this thing say something about that?
Let's see. Why don't you read it?
So if you want to fully arrive at this place, first you must give up everything. Don't even seek the realm of Buddhahood or Zen mastery.
That's for sure.
How much less should you have any self-love or dislike of others? Without arousing any intellectualization, just see directly. There is definitely something that has no skin or flesh. Its body is like space with no particular form or color. It's like pure water being clear through and through. Empty and clear, it is just a matter of being completely aware of it.
Yeah, you see, I think that... you want to be able to certainly not seek the realm of Buddhas or patriarchs, not feel like you're endlessly chasing an idealization that's on the horizon. That's what Hegel called unhappy consciousness. You create an ideal and then it forever falls short, right? I think a lot of Zen students live in that realm. They create a fantasy of the enlightenment that's always on the horizon. Right? What you arrive at, I mean, I think you have to watch out for the fantasy, though, that you arrive at something in that's perfectly clear and empty and bottomless and all that stuff. I mean, I think the world is all those things as it is. And I think that's what you end up seeing in the mirror. You know, it's just this boundless life going in every direction that has no no arrow. You know, there's no direction signal to it.
I like that. That reminds me of business, because it's the sense of activity, you know, this activity of intimacy in life.
Yeah, I think that, be intimate with the business of life. Right? You know, it's the stock market that never closes. Right? Trading goes on forever, right?
Yeah. It's an interesting time now, though. I was reading the article in the New Yorker about Myanmar this week, and it's an interesting time because in Japan, Zen is on the decline. In a lot of Southeast Asia, there's very
nationalist, anti-Muslim
sentiments,
right,
towards things. Mm-hmm. And here and in Europe, Zen is growing. It's experimenting, it's doing different things. So it's interesting that that's the state of it now.
Yeah. It's somehow it got transplanted and it's thriving here. It's probably mutating in the process. I think the idea of transplanting it and having it be a replica of what it was in Asia, I think, is a fantasy, but who
knows?
Isn't
it just what happened in the past, though? You know, there's nothing new about this.
Yeah, it's what keeps happening, yeah. You know. Chinese Zen wasn't Indian Buddhism, and Japanese Zen isn't Chinese Zen. Yeah. We'll see. Thank you all.
Thank you.